this week's program, a conversation with Simone Shaheen. The Palestinian composer and oud and violin virtuoso performs at the Kimmel Center tomorrow afternoon. Susan Lewis looks at Philadelphia Dance Project's upcoming series. Performances over 3 weekends will pair local contemporary dancers with dance artists from around the country. David Patrick Stearns profiles Placido Domingo. The superstar tenor performs with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia in mid-February. To accommodate our fun drive, we've decided to hold over Jason Pfeiffer's exploration of the legacy of Charles Darwin and the numerous Philadelphia organizations celebrating the Year of Culture. You'll be able to hear that feature next week.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Simone Shaheen, the Arab-American musician and composer, is internationally acclaimed for his music on the violin and the oud, a pear-shaped, non-fretted Arabic lute. A Palestinian born and raised in northern Israel, Shaheen came to the United States in 1980. Shaheen has been hugely influential in helping to popularize Arab music and to give listeners in the West an understanding of music from the East. He's performed all over the world and composed beyond the concert stage for theater and film. He also champions musical fusions of Arab, jazz, Western classical and Latin American music. He's joined forces with the Philadelphia Orchestra's Udi Bar David in the past in performances with Intercultural Journeys, which is dedicated to fostering cross-cultural understanding through music. I met with Simone Shaheen following a masterclass organized by Al Buston, Seeds of Culture, at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts last week, and first asked him if he felt that even today there was still a lack of understanding and even a fear of Eastern music in the West.
I don't think there is any fear in the West as far as listening or comprehending music from the Eastern Basin, let's say, of the Mediterranean, especially the Arab world, including Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and North Africa. No, this is not my experience. It never was my experience since the 1980. When I came to this country, nobody heard or listened to Arabic music. Actually, people heard what we call Eastern music, or Oriental, they call it at that time, Oriental music, in the cabaret scene, like in the major cities in New York, Chicago. So they listened to a music that was a mishmash, or that was constructed of Greek, Armenian, Turkish, Egyptian music put together. And actually, the musicians themselves came from those countries, but they met and played together. So this wasn't a pure representation of real traditional or classical Arabic music. So when I came in 1980 to this country, I attended the Manhattan School of Music and Columbia University for higher education. But at the same time, I started to reach out to performing arts centers, to universities, colleges, even elementary and high schools, in order to perform and offer residencies, workshops, lecture demonstrations. So these are all educational tools that would help the public to understand the music, understand the tradition, and live it as an experience rather than understand the component, you know. And, you know, when I gave the first performance in New York with the World Music Institute, I had 30 or 35 people at the concert. 2 nights ago, I played in Los Angeles at the Skirball Center, and we had 1,200 people. When I play in New York, we have 2,000 people come to listen to us. So I think this is, it reflects how people, when people get acquainted with something and they learn about it, and everybody has the ears.
But it really is that simple. Put this music, expose people to this music.
Definitely.
And it doesn't matter what your cultural background is, you will get it.
No, there is no difference. You know, there are differences in between cultures, but they are many common aspects that, you know, that brings people together. Why we always talk about understanding? I mean, if there is no the common aspects that connect people together, then people will never have any understanding, will never enjoy each other. Why Americans would go to let's say to Indonesia and eat Indonesian food, and they would go, "Oh, it's great." So this is commonality, you know what I mean? It means that we have the buds that enjoy also their food. And I think it works the same thing with the brain cells.
And with the ears.
Definitely, no doubt.
You're no stranger to Philadelphia. You've been here many times before to perform, and you've also done work with, I believe, Intercultural Journeys. How important was that for you?
You know, I always like to work on, beside my traditional Arabic music and beside my own compositions and the fusion that I do, I like to work on other projects as much as I can, of course. So I do projects with different groups of musicians, different genres of music. I can work with maybe a flamenco group from Spain or from Philadelphia, Cultural Journey. I work with, jazz group from New York. It's easy for me to get involved with these things, work with any musical expressions in the world, simply because when I was a little kid, even at the age of 4, I was exposed to Arabic traditional music, Western classical music, I mean at depth, American jazz, and, you know, all the surrounding music genres from Iran to Indian to Turkish to West African and so forth. I always was exposed to this. I learned it and I heard it continuously. It became part of me, of my composition as a human being. So when I came to the United States in 1980 to New York, specifically to New York, I really felt at home because this was the culmination of my journey because I was exposed to all these musical expressions in one place.
Simone Shaheen. He performs at the Kimmel Center's Parliament Theatre tomorrow afternoon at 3.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia Dance Projects has been supporting contemporary dance and dancers since the mid-1990s when it grew out of a mentoring project with Jacob's Pillow, home to the internationally renowned Summer Dance Festival in Massachusetts. Today it continues to nurture the Philadelphia dance community with programs, workshops and studio space. Its current venture is a new series pairing local contemporary dancers with dance artists from around the country. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the nature of contemporary dance with the festival's curator and a couple of its participants.
Toddlers may bob and sway to the music, children skip, and teenagers might shuffle, rock, or even roll. But many grown-ups say they don't dance, nor do they go to dance performances, fearing perhaps that they might not get it. Yet if what is beauty is in the eye of the beholder, what is dance may be in the legs, arms, in fact, the entire body of the dancer, particularly contemporary dance, especially today.
In contemporary dance, anything goes.
Terry Fox is executive director of Philadelphia Dance Projects and curator of its new series. She traces the history of contemporary dance back to the break from ballet.
The founders of modern dance took off the toe shoes, they danced in their bare feet, they freed the body, and it was an art for women, sort of a feminist rebellion, if you will, around 1900s into the 1920s.
In the 20s, Martha Graham began expressing serious social and political issues in dance. In the 30s, Ted Shawn founded an all-male modern dance troupe at Jacob's Pillow. In 44, former ballet dancer Merce Cunningham teamed with avant-garde composer John Cage, setting the stage for the increasingly abstract work of postmodern dance. A decade later, Paul Taylor formed his company and added everyday gestures into his dances. And in the 60s and 70s, says Amy Smith, co-director of Philadelphia's Headlong Dance Theater, postmodernism flourished in New York City's Judson Church movement.
It was about being inclusive of all different kinds of movement and all different kinds of activities. So you'd have a piece in which everyday average people are just walking across the stage.
Today, contemporary dance draws from everything. This series sets Philadelphia work in a larger geographical context. For although variety exists within each city, Fox says there are movements in each community.
There's a lot of really great experimental stuff happening in Minneapolis, and Seattle has very formal concerns, and sort of San Francisco's all over the place.
And in Philadelphia?
There's a lot of great dance theater that Headlong has sort of spearheaded and that people are beginning to want to do more of.
Headlong Dance Theater was founded by former college classmates Andrew Simonet, David Brick, and Amy Smith.
We wanted to create a new model for a dance company that was not based on the idea of a single director, choreographer, visionary, but that was a collaborative model.
They collaborate on just about every aspect of the creative process. The resulting dance is a blended mixture of ideas and styles, informed by the variety of experiences of its creators.
My training includes ballet and jazz and tap and West African dance. Andrew and David come from a background that includes sports and acting and sign language. And we include all of those elements in the vocabularies that we create.
The deeper challenge is to create something canny and new that responds to the material, as opposed to now I'm doing jazz, now I'm doing ballet. I would call that a little undigested.
Brick says he and his headlong co-directors create a new vocabulary for each work and look for virtuosos in fluidity and movement.
Can our dancers manifest many, many different styles of movement? Can they create movement we've never seen before? Can we all like invent dynamics and qualities of movements that don't belong to a single style? And that's the way in which it feels like a contemporary art.
The process of creating this contemporary dance is also different from the way ballet is made. Instead of teaching steps, the choreographers bring the dancers an idea, then work on it together. For example, Smith led the way on a work called Universal Humanoids, based on her research about first-person reports of alien abductions. She and dancers Heather and Nicole were listening to a song called Human by the rock band The Killers.
And the lyric goes, "Are we human or are we dancer?
Are we human or are we dancer?"
So I went to the internet and I looked at all these pages and pages of blogs trying to understand, why would he say dancers? Why did he say dancer singular? So we start making a dance to that song that is just absurd and funny. There's a moment where Heather's doing a headstand and her legs are kind of making a diamond, and Nicole like puts her head through them like she's being born through Heather's legs, and then she picks her up and Heather raises her arms up to the ceiling like she's trying to attract the attention of the extraterrestrial creatures up there.
The physical nature of the dance taps into a larger human need, says David Brick.
We live in a very disembodied moment. We have lots of awesome technology. There's a lot of two-dimensional art. There's a lot of surfing the internet. And all of these things, you know, are located in the eyes and the ears, but nothing below the neck. At some point, the culture is going to be like, hey, where's our body?
Contemporary dance, informed by collaboration, advanced by experimentation, infused with both seriousness and humor, and a belief that dance is more than entertainment. It's a way of making one's path through life.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Philadelphia Dance Projects 09 begins today with a workshop this afternoon and a discussion tonight with Jennifer Munson, a dance artist who is dancing her way across America following the migration of birds. Next week, Headlong Dance Theatre performs in a program with Keeley Garfield Dance from New York. Subsequent weekends feature Philadelphia artists Zane Booker and Charles Anderson, as well as artists from Minneapolis, San Francisco, and Seattle. Plácido Domingo first came to Philadelphia not as a star, but as an opera fan. And standing at the back of the Academy of Music, he listened to some of the great singers, ones he would later replace. But soon, as the saying goes, he'll be coming back as a star. And, for that matter, one of the greats in opera history, in a gala concert for the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. It'll be his first Philadelphia experience in more than a quarter century. But why now? How is it that at an age that in tenor years makes him the Methuselah of his breed, he's still able to come back? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns came back with a few answers from a recent press conference at a Center City, Philadelphia hotel.
So, welcome to Philadelphia after 25 years.
It's my pleasure, yes, it's
Thank you.
He's sung 124 different roles, recorded 101 full-length operas, and has made 50 videos. No wonder Plácido Domingo mainly knows Philadelphia from the Amtrak station. He passes through it between his main vocal outpost, the Metropolitan Opera, and one of the two companies he runs, the Washington National Opera. But before Philadelphia's civic pride gets all wounded, the city can be credited with having a seismic impact on one of the world's greatest and most durable tenors. He confesses that Mario Lanza first inspired him to sing. And then there was Franco Corelli, whom Domingo heard in one of his great performances with Birgit Nilsson roughly four decades ago in Philadelphia.
That was extraordinary, and I was lucky to be standing at the academy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yes. You were standing?
Yes.
Standing room?
Yeah.
Oh no.
Oh yes, I don't. I mean, nobody knows me those days, you know. So I was able to find standing room.
At age 68, Plácido Domingo is easily the only tenor of his generation with such a full singing schedule, thanks to an odd reversal of fortune. The very thing that was once a point of unfavorable comparison with Luciano Pavarotti is now what enables Domingo's longevity, the expectation of the high C. Pavarotti was the king of them. Domingo's hallmark was always a darker tone, his sense of style, and ability to act, all qualities that, unlike high C's, aren't lost as a singer ages. But that doesn't mean there weren't some things about Pavarotti that he envied.
I kind of enjoyed very much his vocal control and technique, you know. It was really, really amazing the way he projected every sound in the right way with this God-given beauty in the voice and also the special facility for the top notes, you know. But I do have to work a lot, you know, to make my way up. And I always admire singers and they have that facility.
If it's possible for a singer to be a tenor by design as much as by talent, it's Domingo. He began as a baritone, but as his now deceased press agent Edgar Vincent once put it, this was a voice that was built brick by brick, so consciously, so analytically, that Domingo is able to study a score on an airplane and work out which muscles he'll use to sing it. That's also why, unlike many singers, Domingo has such a clear idea of what he can or can't do at various age points in his life, from Wagner to mariachi. His mantra is that he doesn't want to sing a day longer than he should, but not a day less than he can.
Me cansé de rogarle. Me cansé de decirle que yo sin ella de pena muero. Ya no quiso escuchar.
Still, it puzzles me, you know, why I still can sing, you know. But every morning when I wake up, I say, well, let's hope I can. And so far I have been able, so I think the odds are very, very good that I will be singing next month, you know.
His concert promises to be a fundraising windfall for the chamber orchestra, but it ironically fills a scheduling void left by financial problems at the other company Domingo runs, the Los Angeles Opera. Plans for him to sing the world premiere of an opera based on the film Il Postino had to be postponed. You'd think that the great Domingo would be immune to such things. Not so.
We have a phenomenal box office results, especially in Washington, because the theater is smaller, you know. The public hasn't diminished. It's just that it's more difficult to find the money.
If he's true to form, and a form that he's often been hesitant to discuss, some of the money he'll make from the concert just might fill budget gaps in the operas he's producing. But running opera companies is not the only way in which Domingo assures himself of a life in the theater beyond singing. He's already talking about returning to Philadelphia as a conductor.
It's just, I mean, an hour from New York, so I have so much time in New York and in Washington that I hope that I come at least to visit. And I really hope to one of these days to come back either to sing a full opera or to conduct your very prestigious orchestra.
Prestigious orchestra? Which one do you think he's talking about? The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia has carved out a distinctive musical niche the likes of which any great city would be lucky to have. But unless you live here, you probably don't know that. Could Domingo be possibly referring to, perhaps, the other prestigious orchestra in town? The one that's off touring the capitals of Europe right now? The one that has a conductor situation that might be described as, how should I put it, fluid?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Plácido Domingo performs in a gala fundraising event for the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, Verizon Hall, on February 16th. that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.